You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Thanks for tuning into RCR, Reality Check Radio. The following interview contains topics that some listeners may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. If you would like to contact us in regards to any of our content, please email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. That's inbox@realitycheck.radio.
Welcome back to Reality Check Radio with Marie. You're here with Counterculture, and this is a story that we've been wanting to pull together and bring to you for some time. You will not want to miss this. This goes to the heart of so many issues that many of us have seen here in New Zealand, particularly in relationship to the bureaucratic web that gets woven in our society and the power of how individuals can hold a tremendous amount of power. Unelected individuals can hold a tremendous amount of power and literally wield that power to destroy families and lives in this country. Now, joining me now is Melissa Davies. And Melissa, you have a story. You reached out to us. You've spoken and given testimony to two royal commissions around Oranga Tamariki. There has been plenty of media around many of the misgivings and shortfalls of Oranga Tamariki. And you are somebody who has been at the forefront of this now for 22 years. I really do appreciate you giving your time today to tell your story. So welcome along. And for you, this started all the way back when?
So we're looking at 22 years ago, so when my daughter was 13 and a half,
Just to give people some context, you're a mum, you live in the beautiful Whangaparoa Peninsula, you have a lovely home, you've had a lovely family life, you had your daughter, your lovely daughter Jessica, you recently married, and you were blending a family. So start there. You were blending a family. What then happened from there?
So I returned from my honeymoon and I engaged with a local councillor, which RCR will be familiar with, and this particular character. But anyway, the reality was that that was probably the worst decision I could have ever made. My motivation was purely on the basis that you've got a new dynamic. So I was a single parent for 8 years, mother. my oldest daughter was just, we're incredibly close. She was at a private school, Wentworth College in Gulf Harbour. My whole life was all about being the best parent I could be, giving her an amazing life in the beautiful coast here. Her desire was to become a lawyer. She was an A-grade student. Notably, she had a whole life and world ahead of her. And one day that changed forever, which the outcome has been, beyond horrific.
So you went to the counsellor to sort of just help her blend into the family with your new husband, and he had children as well, yes?
So basically, effectively, my older daughter then had a stepbrother. So yes, there was a new dynamic, which from, my perspective, it was just this genuine desire to do the best at this immediate new adjoining of a family, really.
So the counsellor misconstrued a drawing that Jess had made. And from that, all of these dominoes started to fall. Explain then, she had a drawing.
So she had a drawing that indicated that both my daughter and my new husband were on a large sofa, and he had just come back from work. He literally fell asleep on the couch, and for some reason, through falling asleep after starting work at 4:35 in the morning as a builder, his arm swung out and his finger touched her face. Now, all I know is what the police told me, so that's actually the allegation. But from the moment that that allegation was made to this particular councillor, she contacted police. She had Oranga Tamariki, or then SIFS, have the ability to remove my daughter. Subsequently, in 2023, through an internal investigation, we found out this particular councillor has had some horrendously heart-disturbing sexual abuse of her own life. And I believe with my heart of hearts, and so does my daughter Jessica, that she has almost brought her personal sexual trauma from reading the books that she has written into her counselling practice. Now, had anybody known in this local community that this woman had gone through the type of horrific, indescribable sexual abuse, that she was in absolutely no position to counsel children in a family situation that obviously was just in need of just working through a new dynamic.
From that mistake from the counsellor, a complaint gets made to police, and then next minute you've got SIFs knocking on your door.
Yeah, so basically she didn't come home that day. So as I said, I was a single mother and on a minimum, you know, wasn't highly paid, but I put everything into paying for her to have a private education. When she didn't come home, there were serious concerns. She was taken from that second or basically counselling session by police, a youth police officer who this woman, this counsellor, had engaged with. She was taken literally to his private residence where she stayed for 4 nights. This is a police officer, sworn in police officer. The thing that was quite disturbing was that day, I mean, I remember my very, very, very good friend of 30 years now, we were searching the beach looking for my daughter, thinking this is just so out of character. I've never, you know, we could not understand what was going on, and nobody told us anything. And later we got a knock on the door, and it was a social worker basically who walked into my home. And I remember it's the vivid picture of her and everything she was wearing, and that's how many years later. So every detail, because of the alarming points she made. So what she said was, it's okay, you know, I've got 3 children, 1 in jail, 1's on drugs, you know, just a disturbing story there. But anyway, she came to tell me the disturbing news. My daughter was taken by SIFs and would not be returned back to me. Yeah, and that is the, you know, I think of many moments in my journey, but that moment is the most indescribable pain anyone mother could ever imagine. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, if you're not being told, I mean, if one of my children didn't come home from school, I'd be frantic. So it must have been awful. So just to clarify too, so the counsellor makes this error. Jessica gets uplifted from school with this query of sexual abuse. Did she deny this? Did they ever ask Jessica, are you in danger? Are you in a place that you're concerned about? Has there been abuse? Was she ever asked this?
She always, always maintained that she never said there was sexual abuse or any type of abuse. So that's even more disturbing from the perspective that a counsellor took information that was, to me, more about her life experience rather than trying to support this process of, yeah. So, yep, no, she, to this day, and, you know, she's even this morning we chatted, and, you know, it's horrifying to think that information can be used in these situations that are completely unfounded. I mean, the police detective arrived at my home the following day, and my immediate response was, I'm a newly married woman. My husband, for whatever it might look like, I still took the precautionary step of asking him to leave the family home until we had investigated, or until I had some closure on where this was going and what had happened, which he went up north, he stayed with his family. But the disturbing thing is when the detective arrived to my home, he got out of the car, he walked to the front door, I opened the door, and he basically had this bit of paper in his hand, and he said, can I come in? He said, I'm struggling to even understand this notification that's come through from this counsellor, and the degree of how it is that your daughter's been uplifted from this beautiful home. And he read the notification. So worst case scenario, you're dealing with a notification of my daughter being removed on the basis that my husband had fallen asleep on the couch, watching the news or TV, whatever, and after a long day physically building, he'd fallen asleep and his hand had literally reached out and his finger had touched her face. So that is the information that detective read to me. He sat down and he literally got that notification in his hand. He screwed it up and he said to me, look, I'm so sorry to waste your time. There is no sexual abuse here. There is nothing we can work with as New Zealand Police, but we will be immediately ringing SIFS and letting them know that your daughter must be immediately returned back to your care. That was, and again, I need to confirm dates, but I think she came back 14 months later. She was taken to Paikau.
Okay, so you've got a policeman that, as far as the police are concerned, there is no case to answer. This is ridiculous. This is a spurious claim.
Mm.
So then, therefore, the police would have contacted then the SIFS. Mm. Who at SIFS? Why did SIFS not then follow? The police have done their due diligence. Why then was Jessica not released? Have you ever gotten to the bottom of that?
No. Again, it's my still, I maintain all day long, that police have little power when it comes to a rangatamariki like the family courts. And that's back then. Look how many years we're dealing with. We're dealing with the same set of realities now in 2024. Police don't want to be doing a lot of these uplifts. You know, you can see it in their faces. They don't want to be involved. And I know firsthand that the, you know, police I know personally that I've spoken with, it's the worst thing they could ever imagine, but they have no other option. They've got to follow the directive of the social workers. Now, some of these social workers have had, in some cases, 2 weeks training, and they're destroying lives. To me, it's been a power play. They've got this enormous, unbridled power that you couldn't even imagine.
So here you are at home. The detective said there's nothing he'd answer to. You're then waiting to get Jessica back, thinking, okay, well, this is dealt with. Meanwhile, she is moved from where you are in Whangaparā. She is then moved into a home. Talk me through the home that she was moved into for the next 16 months.
Okay, so she had a number of placements, but one of the most hideous placements was she was taken from Tyndall's Beach to Kaikohe to a state-paid home that, I mean, only she could describe vividly, and she's done this with Mike Ferris in an interview, CCHR, where she talks about the environment she was put into. So she was taken up in a V-dub combi van, and this is quite a, that V-dub combi van has a big part in the time, what I will discuss with the abuse. So she was taken up to Kaikohe, bars on the windows. I know the names of the two characters that ran it. They were told to call them auntie and uncle. Now, this beautiful, beautiful girl had been so perhaps, you know, as a parent, overly protected, but never, ever could imagine being put into a place where she had to beg for food. I've never had any worries or concerns for her. She's taken to a place where she suddenly started smoking. She had more access to cigarettes than she did to food. If she went into a fridge because she was starving, she would get a vacuum pipe beating. They were just mattresses on the floor of the main lounge area where the children had to sleep. And in Jessica's case, she didn't even have that luxury. She was made to sleep in that V-dub combi van with no windows, smashed windows. And where that particular vehicle became quite significant was the one and only time I was invited to a SIFS, they call it, and I think they still do, an FGC in Takapuna at the time. So what we're dealing with is, to me, it's a
family group conference from memory. Yeah. Yes, correct. Right. Yep.
All my take is a foregone conclusion, FGC. Yeah, because what you've got before you even enter the building and I've seen that many times, is they have already, the conclusions of the meeting are already wrapped up before anybody's involved. And that's clearly the case. And most people would actually appreciate that if they've been involved in the FGCs. So what we've got is this one and only time. My nana at the time was alive. Her and I went down to Takapuna. And all I can remember is this most, I mean, I keep reiterating, there is nothing worse in this world than losing your own child, apart from losing your own life. And in my case, I've had two generations. I've lost my daughter and I lost my grandchildren. So where it becomes incredibly horrifying is that I did go to this FGC, and when I walked on the path to go up to the building, there was a V-dub combi van. And of course, me having no knowledge of what Jessica had been subjected to up at Kaikai, this van was parked over yellow lines. The first thing I noticed was just these girls getting out. And one of them was Jess, and she was just saw me and screamed Takapuna down, mum, 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 you know, yep, mum, mum. She ran for me, and the man, the Maori man, just literally ran after her. He'd locked her down to the concrete footpath, and visibly I could see she'd got a gash on her head. She was then taken by this man, and it'll come to me their names, but it's probably not that important, only that I will say that this particular facility was shut down for paedophilia, for sexual abuse later. Jess has, you know, said to me that that never actually happened to her, but she was aware of a lot that was going on at this particular facility in Kaikoui. But yeah, so basically we've got my daughter that has been denied even saying hello to her own mother. She was taken up and we had the FGC. I arrived, I was told I wasn't allowed to have anything to do with Jess or even to have any contact or even a hello or acknowledgement. They took her into a room and I just will always remember the screaming, I want my mum, I want my mum. So my nana and I just sat there trying to comprehend what was, you know, what was going on. Yeah, so that was, and then when we left, which was obviously with a, you know, with no result apart from the emotional trauma of having to see Jessica go through that, we left and the V-dub combi, once again, I talk about this van, I noticed no warrant, no registration, covered in rust and broken windows. The sad reality was finding out later from Jessica's testimony to Mike Ferris of CCHR, that was the very van because there was no room in the facility she had to live and sleep in. So that was her home. That was her home. That was stake here. That's yeah. What took my daughter from, you know, from a world of opportunity and a life. And, you know, I always talk about the butterfly effect and no one could ever imagine what that really means and see what this journey is with the family.
So whilst she is in this, for her, this unimaginable hell in Kaikoui, she obviously was introduced to some unsavoury characters. Fast forward now, so you have this meeting, she's whisked back to Kaikoui, you're just left strung out. Then 16 months later, what? Tell us what happened 16 months later when Jess returned.
She did get taken from Kaikoui and put into a couple of placements. So one of those placements was all SIF placements. One of them was with a woman that, again, you know, as Jess keeps saying, you know, this whole cigarette thing, you know, you if you behave, we'll give you a pack of cigarettes. That was seemed to be the constant reality of Jessica's life. But anyway, so this particular placement was with a woman that had a number of children in her care, and basically one of them was one that raped her. That, and I say rape because it's not consensual at 13, 14, as far as I'm concerned, unless the law's changed. And that's a history that has presented itself in the future of this beautiful girl that came from that particular state care abuse, because it is a state care abuse. So this character, I'll call him, basically raped Jessica. She got pregnant, and when SIF, so beg your pardon, found out she was pregnant, they then dumped her off like a beaten, abused dog. And I didn't even have the courtesy of a knock on the door. It was pretty much a vehicle pulled up to my drive and dumped her off. So there was no explanation. She, the social worker, drove away. I never heard from them again. I didn't realise she was pregnant. I was just obviously incredible. I guess elated that, you know, I had my daughter back, returned to me, but incredibly disturbed about what I then went on to learn about what she'd experienced. So within a day, there was clear signs of her vomiting and really sick. I took her down to our local medical centre and had they tested her for pregnancy, so she was very far on pregnant. Yeah, and Jess has no doubt that they knew, and so she was just too much of a problem for them.
So she's returned to you and she stayed with you through having her daughter, her beautiful daughter, Alia. One of the things, and just in terms of the notes that I have here, she ran back to her gang affiliates. So talk me sort of through that. So in that time, I mean, there's obviously been, she's had to learn how to survive. I'm picking there is a strong survival instinct in Jessica all the way through. And she, in one of these places, was through gang connections, which, how did those happen? Was that via one of these placements she got sort of pulled into that?
Totally, yep. So the only people, if you can imagine, you've gone from a 10 decile area like Whangapuaa or Tindall's in the schools and the private education to suddenly losing everything she even knew. So they became, and I guess that's quite an historic fact about how people draw to gangs, is that that becomes their family. And what happened was that her association became, they were her family for that 16 months or however long it was. The disturbing fact about that is that you're dealing with a 14-year-old child having the child. And she came back almost, I'd almost call her unrecognisable in terms of just because of her trauma, but her personality, just everything. It was like having my daughter Jess taken, but someone I didn't really know returned, but pregnant. And that's completely, like all the way through, say she is the victim here, along with many, but she is a victim of government abuse and the overreach and power. So she was returned back to me heavily pregnant, so much so the medical centre had just immediately booked her in for a late-term abortion. Due to the fact I had quite strong Christian beliefs, I personally made the decision I wouldn't go ahead with it. So I cancelled the abortion, thinking, well, hang on, it didn't quite sit right with me for her to, you know, to abort this baby. Rightly or wrongly, that was the decision I made. So, yeah, from there, we've got a 14, basically turned 15-year-old mum. And she obviously clearly couldn't deal with that. She'd lost her whole childhood. She'd lost the most important years of a young teenager's life, just gone. And so she, one day, I remember she just left. Yeah, she left because, you know, obviously I'd taken on the responsibility. I had my second daughter. There's exactly 9 months between the two of them. And I had decided, no matter what happened, that obviously I would bring up Alia, you know, as if she's my own, because now the situation, I had no other option, and certainly was more than happy to make that work.
So you're now raising your granddaughter Alia along with your also infant daughter Raquel. So you've got the two of them there. Where did Jess go to? So she's gone back to the gang. Was there someone specific that she went back to?
All I know, there was definitely contacts. So that brought about, obviously, the future impact of her life. So I think the real reality is she had literally lost her childhood. Every time, I guess, she would see this beautiful baby, that it would remind her of the abuse too, to be fair. And she just wanted to reconnect with, yeah, associates that she'd met through.
Yeah, through that poor placement. So here you are with these two infants, and you're doing what every mother and grandmother would do to care for this child.
Without any state involvement. I mean, that's the most powerful thing through my journey, is my desire. So it's like, for me, how do I, you know, I could go back to this very organisation that actually was the cause and the problem, but I never ever chose to do that. And all the way through my story, that's been the most powerful statement I could even make. I have no trust and never will trust this agency. So you've got a basically a situation where there's a baby that's been born through the horrific, unimaginable neglect of SIFs, okay, and this baby, you know, this pregnancy happened. It was my choice to allow. I guess I could have opted for the abortion, but it was late term, and it just, for me, just felt like, you know, it just didn't sit right. So,
well, you're heaping more trauma on an already traumatic, a child, and on, essentially, aren't you? So, I can understand that. Yeah. So then you've got a time of stability, I guess, with you and these two babies. What then happened next?
And in no way do I want to deflect from Jess's, you know, what she's gone through. But she did come back after she'd had, you know, this bad affiliation and decided that she would, I think that possibly Ali was around 2 at this point and wanted to take her back into her care, decided that she wanted to be the mother. And I totally embraced that. Yeah, it was not a great, I guess, coming back into our lives, and there were concerns. But again, I keep coming back to this, you know, you're dealing with a mother that shouldn't have been a mother at that age. Mm. She came back and she did her, I guess, her level best, but she still had some association of people that really were not good. So then she, yeah, I'm not sure to go forward and talk about the fact that she met a man that became the, yeah, gang, this huge gang affiliation, huge. And she went on to have, at this point, 2 children to him.
So there's now, so by this stage, she's what, 19, 20, 3 children, cool. Gang affiliated boyfriend.
Yeah, totally. Very, very much so. I mean, the father is one of the most notorious gang members in the country. But the point is that what we're dealing with now is a case of me still reaching out to try to help. And I had them living in the rental property that was next door to me. What I soon saw after nearly a year of, you know, no rent paid and just this horrible feeling that something is going on for my daughter and these kids. We live next to the park and the beach, and there was just no opportunity. It was almost very similar to what I'll talk about with the uplift. So I could just clearly see something was really, really wrong here. So in 2014, myself and my parents went down to the Orewa site. And I don't know how to explain how hard it is to go back to the very agency that I believe this is all. Yeah, it's like going back to, if you believe in the evil of this world, it's almost like going back to that and saying, well, please help me, please help me. So in 2014, we had a meeting with a woman called Trish Lupton, who was a social worker at the time. We sat down, we talked about the concerns of the curtains always shut, you know, got a rental property, which is, you know, weird, actually the same ironic property that Jess was removed from that I owned. And there was this sense at that meeting that they were going to do absolutely nothing. So what I now, well, know to be true, but at that time saw that there was potentially drugs involved, and obviously that was the case. So they ignored the letter, and so much so that I went home, and within a few days I actually went over there, and there's, you know, again, deadlocks on the doors. My daughter had no ability to even get out or have any time alone with me to talk about the abuse with the partner. And so what we've got is that when I just kindly chatted and said, is everything okay? And I said, you guys are not by any chance have anything to do with drugs, do you? That afternoon, the gang affiliates came and they collected their things and they went out to West Auckland to literally the family, the gang family. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you got too close to the truth. So they pulled them further away. Oh gosh, that's so tough. So Jess, the boyfriend, the now 3 children are out in Waitakere. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a mum, so I'm picking that you had, you know, really dreadful concerns. So did you go out to Waitakere? Did you continue to work with what was, I think, was Auranga Tamariki by this stage then, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. To try and, you know, protect these grandchildren, protect your daughter. What was the response?
I had no desire to involve myself with Auranga Tamariki, which is obviously we've got SIFs now, Auranga Tamariki, at all. And I would go out there. I had an interior design business in Matakana and Whangaparoa at the time, and I'd go twice a week. I'd go out there and ensure that they had plenty of food and just make sure that the little ones were cared for. The thing that became more and more disturbing was the evidence of abuse, of serious abuse from the father of these children. There were times where I'd arrive, I mean, there was no way my daughter couldn't open the door. So the abuse was so extensive that I'd have to climb through windows to get into the house. And every time I went, I'd bring shopping and food, and there'd be no food there. But what we've got is my daughter literally like a controlled animal in a home. The children more and more were exposing as neglected and abused, to the point that the bathtub was literally used as just a, you call it a storage facility. There were holes in walls and the internal core doors that of how my daughter was thrown through the doors. And there was dried blood on the concrete garage floor where she had been hit so badly by the partner that the blood was still there, staining the concrete. She had broken ribs. She's got butts that have been... He'd put his cigarette... she's still got evidence today of that kind of abuse. And yet, I got a phone call on the 5th of November 2015 from my daughter saying, we've been evicted from the home, the rental property. And the ironic part was that the mother of this partner, lived just a minute's walk away. And yet she never did anything to protect these little beautiful little children. So the abuse was pretty ongoing. And she said, please, Mum, help me. You know, I need help. We've got nowhere to go. So myself and at the time my best friend, we went out there, and what we saw was just something you can never unsee. Yeah, it was just horrific. Yeah, and I talked to the landlord who lived at the back and talked about, you know, what was wrong and why they got evicted. And it was all drugs and gang related. It was the fact that he said almost every night living at the back of the property, he'd hear Jess being beaten, literally being beaten by this man, and screams, help, help, help. And he said he couldn't do anything. He said a number of times police have been and walked away and did nothing. But I think most important, recognising the amount of times that I had reached out and made notifications. I've personally done that to this agency, and that's probably the hardest thing.
You'd reached out multiple times. This is what I'm trying to wrap my head around, Melissa, is that you reached out multiple times for a mother who is being physically abused by a partner, children who are obviously in danger, police who have been called by a landlord to go to the property because of the abuse that's going on, nothing being done, no one is doing anything with these kids, and yet Jessica, right at the beginning of the story, was uplifted from you by a case of an assumption by a counsellor and the police saying, no, there's definitely nothing here. They're quite happy to uplift you from you then, and now when actual abuse is going on, nothing to see here.
Well, I have an answer to that, and it's very, very clear. So where Aranga Tamariki or SAFS or Ministry of Vulnerable Children, whatever they want to rename themselves or rebrand themselves, the reality is these social workers do a lazy job. They only want to go for the kids, you know, in my case, it was an easy option. So what I see is the vulnerable children like the Malachi that was murdered and all these other, you know, the ones they want to hush under the carpet and not talk about. These are cases where people have reached out and they've talked about, in Malachi's case and so many where these children are being seriously abused. But what we've got in my history or the historic events is that you've got gang affiliation. So they won't touch that. I mean, I reached out and I've got evidence of four occasions of trying to get Jessica and these children safe through Women's Refuge. And Women's Refuge, and fair enough to them, they could not do anything. Each time we'd made a plan and that plan failed, and in the end they explained why. They said, basically, we cannot get involved because of the gang affiliation. So what is going on? You know, what is really going on in this country that you've got an agency that is not fit for purpose, that actually allows these children to, that's the very time they need to step in. They're happy to use police, New Zealand police, when it suits them. When it comes to them getting involved as social workers doing their job, they're not prepared to protect children, and that's their job.
Do you believe that there is a fear by those within Oranga Tamariki not to actually engage where there are gang affiliations? I mean, this is me spitballing here, but...
100%. There is no way that my story is so, so powerful when it comes to their... Okay, so what happened when I arrived at the property in 2015, on the 5th of November, I literally arrived with a friend and then I saw something that, you know, that was such evidence that these children were just, you know, my heart of hearts. And I told my friend Brenda, I said, well, if I leave here today, one or all of these children will die. They will not survive this. The abuse was that enormous. And it wasn't about my daughter. It was about the fact that you've got a gang affiliation. You've got a meth crack addict that had no... when we arrived, there was a sense of calmness. The first thing I did... So we'd arrived about 9 o'clock in the morning. So the first thing I saw was the fridge was just bare. There was not a single bit of food. There was an old yogurt with mold in it. And then I... thought, the first thing I need to do is go down and get, you know, some shopping and give them at least plenty of food to wherever they decide to go, because I don't think there was any desire to come back to me due to the, you know, obviously the reasons they left in the first place. So anyway, I did a big shop, we returned back, and then the food was put there. I offered to make the children, you know, sandwiches, and just... there was just this total control of this man. And then, yeah, and then I just thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this once again. Once again, I'm going to go back to the very agency that was, you know, is meant to be about the care and protection of a child. And I did. I went back down with my friend Brenda. We went down to the Waitakere site, and I was met with a lot of positives, actually, to be really fair. Yeah, something I've not actually experienced before. So I spoke to a woman called Betty, who was the manager at the time. She took me aside. She was clearly concerned about my concerns for these children and this whānau. And she basically said to me that she, as far as she's concerned, we're going to step in. She then made the decision, which she had to because of a geographic, to call the Oriwa Takapuna site, which I understand they're kind of aligned, and I see that now with my journey, that Takapuna is a site, that Oriwa is just a satellite site, and it's all about the cover-up of the history with my family, with this family and Jess. So she made the phone call. She was gone quite a while. She came back to me, and her words with us. She said, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but basically the Oriwa site management have said, we know that Miss Davies, the grandmother, has made many, many notifications of reports of concern. However, these are the powerful words, we do not believe that there is any imminent danger for these children. On the record. Yeah. Okay. So.
Oh gosh. I mean, that must have felt like a kick in the guts.
I left the Henderson OT site going back to the rental property that they'd been evicted from, and I arrived and police were there. So police were there. The father of the children had a baseball bat, threatened to kill my daughter. And the police basically, I guess, didn't know enough information that said, we're just here to calm the peace. And, yeah, it was pretty horrific. Anyway, they left, and things got progressively worse, and I just decided, I had a convertible, I put the lid down, and I decided I'm going to put those kids in there and just go straight down to the Waitakere police station, which I did, and that was 5 o'clock, so I'd had a whole time from 9 till 5 for trying to negotiate what's best for these children with the abuse and the abuser. And, you know, all the while, my daughter was absolutely just like I can't even explain. And that's what I always talk about with her. She was like somebody that couldn't even possibly, like, I guess, gun-shy. I don't know what you call it, but she was just bawling and bawling and bawling and lying on the grass and please help me, please help me. She couldn't even care for herself, let alone her children. And that's big factor in this, is that she, and this is where the story gets really disturbing with what happened after this. So Jess was just, yeah, unrecognizable version of a beaten woman syndrome, of someone that had to live with a monster, literally a monster.
You mentioned before drugs. Was she taking drugs at that time to cope? I mean, was she abusing drugs?
Well, according to Jess, and obviously from her words only, she was almost forced meth because, yeah, that he was a dealer. He was a dealer, so she was almost forced. And no surprise because, you know, if drugs gave her some sense of relief from her past and what she'd gone through and losing her mum and her life and her, even, you know, everything. I mean, I can kind of like, you can't condone it, but you can certainly say, well, no wonder. Yeah.
Another good thing I want to ask you, though, having known a grandmother who has raised a grandchild with a similar situation, one of the things she told me, and she had a situation where the gang turned up on her front lawn, and she'd had this child for years. Similar thing, she uplifted the child herself. She was a Māori woman, and her daughter, Māori gang leader Māori, and the daughter went on to have more children to her abusive partner. And then they all turned up en masse one day to try and uplift the child that was in her guardianship, because finally, after many years, she had formally, this child had a lot of physical and neurodevelopmental issues. They'd formalised her guardianship, which meant she then got paid for the care of her grandchild. And they turned up to take the child off her, claiming, "You can't steal our urn." Do you believe the father of those boys essentially just saw them as an income and not as children?
I'm not sure, because I guess the story gets much larger in that when I removed the children and put them into my care, so that happened on that day. So we're dealing with November 2015. The first thing I did was ensure their care and protection. So I could do nothing. I could not leave those children to die. And that's what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with anything. And I can't make that sound any less believable. That is the truth. These children would have died.
And they're toddlers, aren't they, these boys, at this stage?
So Paul was 20 months. Ethan would have been 3. So just to be clear, we'd had notification after notification made to Aranga Tamariki about Ethan, for example, at 2 years of age, walking the streets of Henderson in a nappy and found 2 hours walk away from where they lived. And that's, I understand, 3 occasions, but police say 2.
Let's now fast forward. You've got the kids. You've got Ethan and Paul.
So I went down to the North Shore District Court and I made personally a no notification order for these children. And that was about the care and protection, until my sole belief was that I got to get my daughter safe from all of this, because she is such a victim. Like, you could not imagine how strongly I feel and always have. So no matter what I've gone through, I've always believed that she is a victim of state abuse. Yeah, no, I'm sure that what you spoke about in the beginning with my 2 daughters, you would understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you've got the boys. Where's Alia?
So she was with me. The big issue I've got is that when Alia was with me, she was happy and just loved living here. But it became a little bit concerning for me that maybe I just did not have the capacity. And I'll tell you why. So I was doing really well until I set out. I hired a private investigator. And, you know, I mean, we're talking another 10K to try to track down my daughter, Jess, because as I keep saying, she is a victim. So I did that, and he came back with very little, apart from just a few leads, but I just couldn't keep justifying paying him more. So I just said, well, thank you. And I took it up and I took the leads and I managed to find my daughter, Jess. So what we've got is I've got the children in my care. You've now got the fact that I went to the family courts and did a no notification order for the children to be put into my care. So that's quite a powerful order, and you've got to obviously present facts. So clearly police then got involved. So the police got involved, and a detective, Peter Law, got involved, and he suddenly interviewed me about how and why I had to take the children. And obviously, you know, I've got to present certain information. So we've got that, and then we've got Yeah, we've got this investigation, which this particular senior police detective said to me, no matter what, I always believe that your daughter is a victim. The father will go to prison, but no matter what, you just, you know, he talked about, and I've got it on the record, 10 hours community service for Jess for neglect, because the new laws with neglect were quite strong. They just come through. So what you've got is an abuser. There's a big difference between an abuser that nearly killed these children and a mother that was a victim of absolute horrific physical, mental, emotional abuse. And he got that, I thought. And it turns out at the very, I guess, just, it ended up becoming a court case. And he kept absolutely asking me to give evidence about the situation, and that evidence I gave was part of the case that my daughter got 3 years, 10 months imprisonment.
For neglect.
For neglect. So he got abuse and neglect. He got out in two. She still had to serve the whole duration in Wiri prison. Yeah.
I could see again. That to me just seems like upside down world. Absolute upside down world. And of course, by this stage, if I get the timeline right, there's also a third. When did the third boy born? When was Noah? Tell me.
Thank you for, it's really powerful when you're saying that, because, you know, that's something that is most, you know, for me, that is the most disturbing part of all of this journey I had, is that, so my desire, like I talked about, getting a detective involved, a private investigator involved, he couldn't locate Jess. And, you know, Jessica to this day keeps saying, you should have been a private investigator, because it's determination, nothing more. Like, I just was so determined. So I went to the gang family, risked a lot by just saying, I just need to find my daughter. I'm really concerned. Out West Auckland, I just kept following the dots, I guess, and I went to the mother, which is the abuser's mother. I talked to her. She gave me a few clues, went from those clues and kept following on. And then finally, I managed to get myself to what is known to be a gang mechanic shop, like a cover-up for stolen cars. And when I did that, I found her. She was out in the, so there, it's a mechanic shop that at the very back, in Avondale, it literally has no, it's just, yeah, there's an open door, and I remember finding her there, and she was on an old mouldy wet mattress. She had been beaten so badly with blood coming out of the side of her face and clear bruises all over her. She was incoherent. It's unimaginable to see
your daughter that way.
Yep. Yeah, and the worst thing is she was skin and bone, like literally skin and bone, and heavily, heavily pregnant. So I just, obviously, it's, you know, again, these kind of feelings like, you found her, I found her, she's safe. You know, this is a victim of the state abuse. I'm going to get her safe. And then I managed to, it took me, I remember it being 20, 30 minutes before I could actually even get her to a place she could talk. So high on meth. And what, you know, I understand is there's a lot of control with the partner. So she was so high on meth, she couldn't talk. And when she did finally get coherent enough, she said, I haven't eaten for 3 days. Well, this is someone that's, you know, you've got a meth baby that's heavily pregnant and she's being starved. And she looked terrible. So I then tried to get her to my car, and the father of the children literally arrived, and he grabbed a crowbar and tried to kill me. And it sounds that crazy, but it's that real. Yeah, he grabbed a crowbar and said, if you take Jessica, I will kill you. And that's when I had to reason with a drugged, you know, abuser. And I just said, well, look, if you want to, that's okay, but you're going to kill Jess and the baby, because there's no possibility either of them will survive. You know, they always talk in the States of the dumpster babies, but I don't believe Jess would have survived. There's no chance of that. No way that baby would have been here today, survived, got through this. So he calmed down for a moment. And as I said, I had a $120,000 vehicle, and he grabbed my keys and he said to me, I'm going to drive your car. And I said, well, you can't do that. Clearly, he was in no state to drive. and I grabbed my second set of keys out of the glove box. I got in the driver's seat, and he then, Jess was in the car, and he then drove behind us to Waitakere Hospital, and that's when he pulled up behind us, opened the door, pulled her by the hair, and dragged her. And I'd called police. They didn't arrive in time, and she was dragged back into his vehicle. And it was only a week later I managed to communicate with Jess to get her to have that baby born in Auckland Hospital. And the ironic part about this is that there's no possibility those two would have survived. No possibility at all. Auckland Hospital, the chief administrator, and I've got the name, said to me, there's no way that either of them would have, because the umbilical cord was, when I got her to hospital, the umbilical cord was round baby's Noah's neck. Jess was hemorrhaging like I've never seen so much blood in my entire life. She was still on meth, and he was on meth. But what we had established, which, this again, my time to do the right thing. Once again, I called out to OT and said, save this baby. Please don't let this baby go back to the parents. Can you imagine how hard that is to go back to once again? I caught this is, I'm not even, I wouldn't even call myself a highly religious person, but this is Satan's organization as far as I'm concerned, because I'm going back to the very organization that are and have created this insanity of a problem. So I called out to Waitakere, and thankfully I did, because I actually see that there was a social worker, which I'm happy to name. Her name was Jervilyn, and she was pretty amazing. So she said to me at that point, before the baby is born, she said, we can't do anything. We can't do anything until the baby is actually physically born and alive. There is no protection for the baby. And I found that really hard. But I guess, it makes a bit more sense now, more as there is not a lot of worth with an unborn child. But, my point would be the social worker actually did step up and support, and she did amazing. So she put Noah into my care. I called him Noah. Anyway, that was the name I named him. But he was put in my care at 2 days old.
So now we've got Jess and the partner serving in prison. You've got the four children.
Plus Raquel. So it's five kids.
Yes, plus Raquel, your lovely Raquel. Yeah. So you've got five kids at home. And then for a while, a period again of stability ensues. So these kids have safety for the first time in their lives, some of them. Mm-hmm. They've got some stability. You must have been, whilst worried about Jess in prison, you must have at least felt that there was hope for this family. I want to thank Melissa for her courage in telling her story, part two of which will air on next week's show. If you have experienced something similar or can relate to Melissa's experience, feel free to reach out to us. 2057 is the text number, and inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email address.
Do you want to be part of something that's big, that matters, and that's making a difference? The RCR Foundation Members Club is here. Get exclusive benefits and the knowledge you're supporting truth and freedom in the media. All the details are on our website at www.realitycheck.radio/members, and see how you can join the mission that's making a difference.